Victor, still as impetuous and self-centered as ever. Alexios got up from his chair and stretched languidly, surprised at how tense his body had become during his brief conversation with the astrobiologist. "Victor didn't recognize me," Alexios said to himself. "Not the slightest flicker of recall. Of course, it's been more than 10 years, and the nanosurgery has altered my face considerably. But he didn't even remember my voice. I'm dead and gone, as far as he's concerned." "All to the good," Alexios told himself. "Now he'll come down here on his fool's errand and destroy himself. I'll hardly have to lift a finger. He's eager to rush to his own annihilation." Alexios dreamed troubling dreams that night. The steel-hard determination that had brought him to Mercury and lured Victor Molina to this hell-hole of a world softened as he slept, thawed slightly as he sank into the uncontrollable world of his inner thoughts, the world that he kept hidden and firmly locked away during his waking hours. In his dream, he was standing once again at the base of the Sky Tower, craning his neck to follow its rigidly straight line as it rose beyond the clouds, up farther than the eye could follow, stretching up toward the stars. Lara was standing beside him, her arm around his waist, her head resting on his strong shoulder. The diamond ring on her finger was his, not Victor's. She had chosen him and rejected Molina. Alexios turned to her, took her in his arms, kissed her with all the tenderness and love his soul could contain. But she pulled away from him, suddenly terrified, her lovely face contorted into a scream as the proud tower began to slowly collapse, writhing like an immense snake of man-made fibers, coiling languidly, uncontrollably, unstoppably, as it slowly but inexorably crashed to the ground. All in silence, in utter silence, as if he had suddenly gone completely deaf. Alexios wanted to scream, too, but his throat was frozen. He wanted to stop the tower's collapse with his bare hands, but he could not move. His feet were rooted to the spot. The immense collapsing tower smashed into the workers' village and beyond, crushing houses and cinder block work buildings, smashing the bodies of men, women, and children as it thundered to the ground, pulverizing dreams and plans and hopes beyond repair. The whole mountainside shook as dust rose to cover all the work, all the sweat and labor that had raised the tower to its full height. Alexios's mouth tasted of ashes and a bitterness that went beyond human endurance. Lara had disappeared. All around him, as far as the eye could see, there was nothing but devastation and the mangled bodies of the dead. "My fault," he told himself. "The sin of pride. My pride has ruined everything, killed all those millions of people." Covered with ashes, his soul crushed along with everything else, he screamed to the vacant sky, "My fault! It's all my fault!" He awoke with a start, covered with cold sweat. In the years since the Sky Tower's destruction, Alexios had learned that the catastrophe was not his fault, not at all. The soul-killing guilt he had once felt had long since evolved into an implacable, burning hatred. He thirsted, not for forgiveness, nor even for the clearing of his name. He lived for vengeance. Thermophiles. Victor Molina also dreamed that night as he slept on the airfoam bed in his stateroom aboard Himawari in orbit around the planet Mercury. He dreamed of the Nobel ceremony in Stockholm. He saw himself dressed in the severely formal attire of the ritual as the King of Sweden handed him the heavy gold award for biology. "The discoverer of thermophiles on the planet Mercury," Molina heard the king announce. "The courageous, intrepid man who found life where all others said it was impossible for life to exist." Lara sat in the front row of the vast audience, beaming happily. Victor reminded himself to add a line to his Nobel lecture, thanking his wife for her love and support through all the years of their marriage. Then he began his lecture. The huge audience hall, crammed with the elite of every continent on Earth, fell into an expectant silence. Thermophiles are organisms that live at temperatures far beyond those in which human beings can survive, he told the rapt and glittering audience. On Earth, microscopic thermophiles were discovered in the latter part of the 20th century, existing deep underground at temperatures and pressures that were, up until then, considered impossible as habitats for living organisms. Yet these bacterial forms not only exist, they are so numerous that they actually outweigh all the living matter on the surface of the Earth. What is more, they survive without sunlight, shattering the firmly held belief that all life depends on sunlight as its basic source of energy. The thermophiles use the heat of Earth's hellish core to derive their metabolic energy. A British cosmologist, Thomas Gold, had earlier predicted that a deep, hot biosphere existed far below the surface not only of Earth, but of Mars and any other planet or moon that had a molten core. Scornfully rejected at first, Gold's prediction turned out to be correct. Bacterial life forms have been found deep below the surface of Mars, together with the cryptoendoliths that have created an ecological niche for themselves inside Martian surface rocks. While astrobiologists found various forms of life on the moons of Jupiter, and even within the vast planet-girdling ocean of that giant planet itself, the next discovery of true thermophiles did not occur until explorers reached the surface of Venus, where multi-celled creatures of considerable size were found living on that hothouse planet's surface, their bodies consisting largely of silicones, with liquid sulfur as an energy transfer medium analogous to blood in terrestrial organisms. Still, no one expected to find life on Mercury, not even thermophilic life. The planet had been baked dry from its very beginnings. There was no water to serve as a medium for biochemical reactions, not even molten sulfur. Mercury was nothing but a barren ball of rock in the view of orthodox scientists. Yet the surprising discovery of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons on the surface of Mercury challenged this orthodox view. PAHs are quickly broken down in the high-temperature environment of Mercury's surface. The fact that they existed on the surface meant that some ongoing process was generating them continuously. That ongoing process was life. Thermophilic organisms living on the surface of Mercury at temperatures more than four times higher than the boiling point of water. Moreover, they are capable of surviving long periods of intense cold during the Mercurian night, when temperatures that sink down to minus 135 degrees Celsius are not uncommon. Now came the point in his lecture when Molina must describe the Mercurian organisms. He looked up from the podium's voice-activated display screen, where his notes were scrolling in cadence with his speaking, and smiled down at Lara. His smile turned awkward, embarrassed. He suddenly became aware that he had nothing to say. He didn't know what the creatures looked like. The display screen was blank. He stood there at the podium while his wife and the king and the huge audience waited in anticipation. He had no idea of what he should say. Then he realized that he was naked. He clutched the podium for protection, tried to hide behind it, but they saw him. They all saw he was naked and began to laugh at him. All but Lara, who looked alarmed, frightened. "Do something," he silently begged her. "Get out of your chair and do something to help me." Suddenly, he had to urinate. Urgently. But he couldn't move from behind the podium because he had no clothes on. Not a stitch. The audience was howling uproariously, and Molina wanted, needed, desperately to piss. He awoke with a start, disoriented in the darkness of the stateroom. Lights, he cried out,